Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Org. Crawford, your co-host.
And I'm Stasz Ziolkowski, your other co-host.
And we're here today on Monday, July 16th, to bring you a show on the theme of personal experiences. Personal experiences. Stasz, that could mean anything.
I know.
Oh, that's why we like it.
That's
okay.
Right.
So we have some great stories planned for you. And some tactical information about storytelling going on in the area, so you know where you want to be.
I'm sorry, tactical information.
Tactical information. You've got to plan your approach.
Military spin on the radio today. No, we're not.
Okay. So, do you want to talk about the Speak Storytelling series and tell our listeners what's coming up?
Yes. Speak Story Series at Shepherd University. And you can find out detailed information at www.speakstoryseries.com. Just this past week, Dovey Thomason was there, and I feel sorry for all the people who didn't attend that because it was just marvelous.
She is one of my favorite storytellers in the whole world, like in the top three, I would say. And that performance was the best I have ever heard.
Yes, that was a wonderful performance.
It was wonderful.
And the after, I call it the afterglow, when she actually careful with this word, disrobed on stage, took off her native
garb. Wasn't that awesome?
And was just there in her normal jeans and shirt and that, and spent a great amount of time answering questions from the audience. In fact, she would never have stopped, I think, if the MC actually started three or four times to cut the audience off, but then she just kept going, answering questions and explaining things in a wonderful, very generous way.
Yeah,
and
it
easy
was
to understand.
Wonderful, wonderful. And that was the...
It's over. That little break is over. There was a tiny little interruption there. Kids next door practicing rock and roll, but we're back. So, Fanny, are you okay?
I'm just ruined for the day. There I don't know go. What it's to little, tell you.
Don't blame the kids. They're just trying to start a garage band. Okay.
It's a good story, though.
August, Corinne Stavish. Corinne specializes in personal and historical narratives and biblical interpretive tales that are warm and witty, powerful and poignant. She's going to present a program, When Good People Do Something, the story of integrity and humanity in World War II occupied Denmark. September 11th, Donald Davis. Donald, was a minister for 20 years or more, and is a minister to all those who go to hear him tell stories. His stories are delightful about his childhood and about his family, and he has a unique way of presenting such wonderful, really, lessons. October 9th, Linda Gorham. Linda's performances are filled with surprising twists and unconventional humor. Each performance is infused with unique signature and sophisticated attitude. November 13th, Megan Wells. Megan has an incredible repertoire of stories. She writes and performs fresh versions of old tales, edited versions of classical literature, and living embodiments of vibrant historical characters. She was recently inducted into the prestigious Circle of Excellence, the National Storytelling Network's award to honor America's best storytellers. And December, coming back because she was snowed out in March, Elizabeth Ellis. And that will be on December 11th. And I guarantee that that will be worth braving the cold and snowstorms, which we might have again. So there is the lineup for the Speak concert schedule.
Thank you, Stosh. I hope we see a representative percentage of our listeners there at each of those sessions.
100% would be even better.
100% would yes. I won't comment any further on those numbers. Okay. Is it time for a story?
I think it is.
Do you want to start? Never mind. I'll go first. And this story will be told in two parts because it's a long one.
Okay.
The ants go marching one by one, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching one by one, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching one by one with a clash of sabers and rattle of drums. And we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. There is a big black ant, an ant on the floor in the doorway of my bedroom, just visible to me from my crib. Behind that ant is another one. Behind that one are two more, and two more after that. And behind them, three, and another three, and then a line of four, and four more coming close behind, and then a longer line, and many, many, many more behind them. I am just 3 years old. I can only count to 20, but I can see lots more ants than 20. The ants are walking, slower than I could walk, but fast for ants, inexorably closer and closer to my crib. It's mostly dark in my room, but there is enough light from the hallway for me to watch their progress across the floor. My face is pressed against the side slats of my crib for a better view of these ants. By the time they reach the legs of my crib, there are many, many more of them, and they're tenacious in their quest to get into my bed. I can feel tears running down my face. There's nowhere for me to go. I'm in my crib. The house is mostly dark. My parents are asleep. There's no one to save me. The ants begin their slow and steady climb up the legs and onto the side rails of my crib. I watch them coming toward me, closer, closer. My face and hair are wet now. I'm sweating. My pajamas are damp around my neck and down the front from my tears. But the ants keep coming over the top rail, down the upright slats, onto the mattress, walking single file across my favorite plaid blanket. So many ants! The long line of them comes closer and closer to my face. Boom, boom, boom. I feel my heart pounding in my chest. The ants go marching two by two. Boom, boom. The ants go marching two by two. Boom, boom. The ants go marching two by two. They're not afraid of me and you, and we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. The ants go marching three by three, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching three by three, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching three by three, with pincers and stingers plain to see, and we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. When I was 3 years old, I had that recurring dream, a nightmare, really, of watching a long line of ants crawling along the rails of my crib. I would watch them, my eyes wide, as they came within inches of my face. I always woke up about this point in the dream, sometimes screaming. I really did not want to tell my mother about this dream because I knew it was just a dream. I knew it wasn't real, and even at 3 years old, I didn't want to hear my mom tell me what I already knew. I remember screaming myself awake at least once, and my mother coming into the room and turning on the light. I don't think I told her what the dream was about, but she dried my tears, covered me up, and soothed me back to sleep. Eventually, I learned to wrest some control from those terrifying ants. I learned to wake myself up and put myself back to sleep, but I always was afraid those ants would return as I slept. My mother knew where that dream came from, because many years later, I was at least 11 or 12, I asked her why I would have been dreaming about ants when I was so little. She said, one day about that time, I was supposed to spend the day with another family while my parents were away for the day. There was a big traffic jam on the way home. Mom and Dad were 5 or 10 minutes late getting back. This was way before cell phones, and public phone booths were not on every corner. Besides, they were in a big traffic snarl-up and trying to figure out the fastest route home. But the family that I spent the day with were also trying to get somewhere for the evening, and they left me on the front steps of our house. They did tell our next-door neighbor what they were doing, and bless her heart, that old lady tried to get me to come inside her house, but I would not. The neighbor brought out candy and lemonade and set them on the step for me, and that car drove away. That family, they left me all alone on the steps, and I sat there for what seemed a long, long time. Somehow, in the confusion and my panic, some of the lemonade spilled, and I got some of that sticky candy and lemonade on my hands and clothes. I wouldn't eat or drink any of it, but I just sat there with my nose running and my face sticky with tears, and the neighbor went back into her house, and I was all alone. Ants began to climb the steps, attracted by the sugar. I watched the ants coming, first just one, then two, then three, and finally a long line of them marching to the spilled lemonade and then into the glass and over the candy and eventually climbing right over my shoes and then over my sticky hands. I tried to shake them off my hands, but I couldn't get them off. And then they were all over my arms, climbing all over me, closer and closer to my face, and by the time my parents arrived to rescue me, I was near hysterical. Now, you might think that experience, or that dream that came to me over and over again, night after night, might have made me deathly afraid of bugs and all creepy crawly things, but you didn't know the Crawfords. We were a camping family every summer from the time I was a baby. My parents loaded up the old green Pontiac with the big green canvas tent, the green Coleman stove, the green Coleman lantern, silver Coleman ice chest, and a huge pile of dark brown army blankets. We would leave Philadelphia, where we lived, drive west and then north into the Pennsylvania mountains, camping at state parks all across Pennsylvania, and then cross into western New York State to visit my dad's family. Of course, every night that we were camping, we were also eating at picnic tables. Ba-boom, ba-boom. Who comes to picnic tables to share your meals? Right, ants. So I had plenty of less traumatic daytime experiences with ants and other wildlife. The ants go marching 4 by 4. Ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 4 by 4. Ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 4 by 4 through the garden gate and the kitchen door. And we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. The ants go marching 5 by 5. Ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 5 by 5. Ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 5 by 5. Get out of the way or they'll eat you alive. And we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. But you know what's really scary? Having a new baby brother. When my baby brother, Dougie, was born, I was 5 years old. And we missed a whole year of camping while he was a baby. that as soon as he was a year old, we were back to traveling with our big green tent. Dougie was something of a budding scientist from that young age. He started out as a zoologist, bringing home exotic life forms, salamanders, toads, beetles, spiders. And one day when I was in ninth grade, years later, and he was in fourth grade, I brought home an ant farm kit that my biology teacher gave me. I really didn't want an ant farm, but I thought Dougie would, and I was a good big sister, so I gave it to him. Of course, if the ant farm turned out to be a success, I could then reclaim it and get extra credit for my biology class. If you've never seen an ant farm, you are to be congratulated. They're actually kind of creepy. Dougie had harvester ants in his ant farm, and he fed them seeds, bits of bread. I wondered why they were called harvester ants. It was not quite a worry, but what might they harvest? Well, that ant farm was a half-inch layer of sand trapped between two small panes of glass inside a wood frame, like a picture frame. The whole thing was encased in a larger clear plastic box with a removable top so that Dougie could add the ants and later bits of food inside the box. The box was kept sealed, so the ants would be trapped inside. They couldn't get out. But there was a little hole in the wood frame around the glass pane so the ants could get into the sand and make their tunnels. When Dougie opened the outer box and left bits of food, the ants would climb out of their tunnels in the sand, get into the bigger box, and carry the food back in small bits to the sand tunnels where they lived. When he wasn't feeding or watching the ants, Dougie kept the glass panes covered with black paper so it would be dark inside the tunnels. The ants liked the tunnels dark. However, that summer, we went camping again for 2 weeks, as we always did, and no one gave the ants a second thought the whole 2 weeks. When we came home, ba-boom, ba-boom, Dougie must have forgotten to close up the exits in the ant farm. Maybe he forgot to feed and water them, too. When we got home, there were ants in a lot of places. There should not have been ants. It took a long time to catch all of them. We made little ant traps with a smooth, shiny stainless steel funnel set down into a wide mouth jar and sealed the edges with packing tape. We didn't know about duct tape then. This is the paleo tape period. But we put honey and breadcrumbs in the bottom of the jar to attract the ants, and they climbed up the jar and into the funnel where they'd jump or fall down into the jar for the food. And once they were in the jar, they couldn't get back out, but we'd rescue them, put them in a different, bigger jar, and by the time we got all those ants collected, there were way too many ants to fit back in that little tiny ant farm. Where did all those ants come from? I was never sure about that. But because there were so many, we took some time to talk about what to do with them. We could not just take them across the street to the park, to Fairmount Park, across Parkside Avenue where we lived, because they would have just waited for the light to change and marched right back across the street and into our house again. So my dad drove us and the big jar of ants out to Reading, PA, where my parents knew a farmer. And he said it would be fine to leave the ants in his barnyard. So that's what we did. And I have no reason to think that after all of these years, those ants are not still happily living in Mr. Hinton's barnyard, Farmer Hinton's barnyard. So far, the ants go marching six by six, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching six by six, ba-boom. Ba-boom. The ants go marching six by six. If they grow thumbs, we'll be in a fix. And we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. The ants go marching seven by seven. Ba-boom. Boom! The ants go marching seven by seven. Boom! Boom! The ants go marching seven by seven. It's either hell or we're bound for heaven, and we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. In South America, army ants appear every few years, some years so numerous they eat everything in sight, including animals if they don't get out of the way, leaving skeletons behind as the ants sweep through the forest. Sitting around a campfire as a seven-year-old at my overnight summer camp, I heard a scary story called The Man-Eating Ants of Brazil, about a farmer and his family living in remote hill country. Army ants were on the march there and eventually got to this farm. They ate through all the crops he'd planted and all the farm buildings where the harvest was stored, and then they started eating the house. So the family burned all the buildings and then the fields, but the ants kept coming. Finally, the family fled to a raft on the river, but ants can swim. Ba-boom. Ba-boom. The ants made a huge raft of their own bodies, holding on to each other with their tiny feet. They came swimming down the river to the family's raft. The family escaped somehow. Maybe they had those little sticky traps that you can buy at Walmart. You know, those little square boxes.
Little strips.
Yeah. But that old camp story was taken from a book and a movie starring Charlton Heston. It was called Naked Jungle. I saw it one night as a teenager on late night TV, and it was even scarier than the campfire story. Don't you want to go see Naked Jungle? Okay, we'll take a break here.
Suddenly, I feel the urge to scratch and get a, and shake my clothes. Okay, that was part one of how to make Stash uncomfortable. The ants. Good.
Yes. Okay.
So you're listening to EnlightenRadio.org Storytelling Hour with co-host Stash Zielkowski and
Fanny Crawford.
Yes. And broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and finish this story, if that's okay.
I think it's a good idea to get that done.
Get us off the cliffhanger. Okay. Well, there are other ant movies. James Whitmore as Police Sergeant Ben Peterson in a movie called Them. Radiation contaminates an ant colony and ants mutate into enormous 7-foot insects. They were hiding out in desert caves, but now live in city sewers, and they are stealing human children. There is a happy ending. The children are found and saved, but there's the question at the end, whether all the giant carnivorous ants have been killed. And then there was a sequel, of course. Well, I told you a story earlier today about a very small ant farm, but there are places where people farm ants in large-scale colonies for food, producing raw materials for chocolate-covered ants, for example. Did you know some ants keep their own farm animals? There's a species that traps and collects aphids, tiny white or green bugs, carrying them to the home colony to live as captives. The ants provide food for the aphids, leaves, and protect the aphids from other predators. The aphids provide the ants with nectar from the plants they eat, and the ants use the nectar to feed baby ants and the queen ant, the mother of the colony. Entomologists, scientists who study insects, call this system farming. They say the ants, as a colony, are highly organized and intelligent to make this system work for them, trapping aphids, carrying them home to the colony, keeping them captive, and stealing their nectar. Entomologists call that mutualism. Since the aphids often live longer in captivity than they would when constantly threatened by birds and other predatory insects, entomologists insist the system is mutually beneficial to ants and aphids. Maybe the ants say that too. Maybe the aphids would call it kidnapping or bondage. The ants go marching 8 by 8, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 8 by 8, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 8 by 8, each carrying 20 times their weight. And we'll all be grateful if the ants go marching home. The ants go marching 9 by 9, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 9 by 9, ba-boom, ba-boom. The ants go marching 9 by 9, they'll crawl up your legs and down your spine. And we'll all be grateful when the ants go marching home. Last night, I woke up very suddenly in a cold sweat. There was something crawling on my feet. Under the bed covers. I jumped out of bed and stepped into the pool of light from the small lamp in the hallway. My arms and legs were itchy and twitchy with goosebumps everywhere, but no bugs, nothing. I looked very carefully, muttering to myself, ants are not the enemy of human beings. Ants are not the enemy of human beings. And after a few deep breaths to calm myself, I walked down the hall to the kitchen for a glass of water, turned on the overhead light, and aha! I saw ants. Enormous, shiny black ants with wiry black legs almost an inch long, and teeny tiny black ants with long, long jointed antenna, and ginormous fiery red ants. Medium-sized brown ants with abnormally large pincers, and red ants so teeny tiny you could hardly tell they were ants. More like little hairy specks. I backed up a step, grabbing hold of the counter. Something wet and sticky adhered to my hand, but I hardly had time to notice because I happened to look toward the pantry, and there, standing on their hind legs, were the two biggest, hairiest black ants I had ever seen. They were at least 18 inches tall, standing that way, with bristly black hairs sprouting from several body parts. They were hideous. But more frightening, they were each holding in their four front legs very heavy loads. The one furthest from me was carrying a 25-pound sack of whole wheat flour, very expensive organic flour that I had just purchased from the Common Market Co-op in Frederick. The monster closest to me was holding, as if they were feathers or an air-filled paper bag, two number 10 cans of spaghetti sauce that I bought for the church potluck this weekend. I brought my hands to my face in shock and bewilderment. Now there was something sticky on my hands and my face. The can of tomatoes and the flour sack fell to the floor. Ba-boom, ba-boom. As those huge insects caught sight of me, and they both simultaneously leapt into the air and hurled themselves directly at my knees. Of course, I stumbled backwards and only then realized there was another one behind me. I toppled backwards over that one, and as soon as I was on the ground, at least a dozen more of those creatures came rushing into the room. By the time I caught my breath and opened my mouth to scream, it was too late. In an instant, two of them grabbed cloth napkins from the linen shelves and stuffed them firmly in my mouth. I could not call out and could barely breathe. Others ripped tablecloths from another shelf and used the strips to truss me up. My hands were tied so tightly behind my back, I thought my arms might break. I could feel flicks of something on my hands. Ant hands and tongues brushing my hands where the sticky stuff was. My ankles were locked in place with yards of the fabric, and wider strips held my knees, hips, and arms still. When they were finished, the ants simply lifted me on their backs and walked me right out the back door. The door was wide open, though I know it was locked, and bolted at bedtime. It gave me a very odd feeling to realize if these animals were able to unfasten bolts, tie half hitches, and square knots, surely humanity is doomed. At the very least, I was doomed. About that time, I became aware of an odd sound. The ants showed no sign or change in their demeanor, but I remembered that ants don't hear as we do, no ears. Instead, they feel sound vibrations through their feet. Nor do they breathe as we do, no lungs. Their outer shells are pocked with minute holes, and air passes in and out, allowing respiration right through their skins. This sound was a deep guttural sound, followed immediately by a hiss, regular and steady. The sound of ants talking to each other in guttural vibrations, or perhaps heavy ant breathing as they work to restrain me and lift me a foot off the ground. They carried me out to the far edge of the garden, a corner of the yard I don't visit regularly. They laid me, oh, so gently on the grass, next to a larger-than-average hole about the size of a very large groundhog's burrow, with a sandy hill of excavated soil next to it, maybe 3 feet high. All of this movement accompanied by rhythmic The monster ants carefully tightened the tablecloth strips about my limbs, their wiry legs, or maybe arms, flicking back and forth across my bare skin. Very, very creepy. Like tiny twigs blowing in the wind or thick bristly hairs touching my skin as they worked. Worse was yet to come. They lifted me again, and others, apparently already in the tunnel, began pulling on my hair to get me perfectly positioned at the edge of the hole and face down in it. It was then I realized the wretched and frightening truth. They meant to pull and shove me down into their tunnels, head first, as food for their abominable egg-encased children. They pulled me, hair first, into the mouth of the tunnel. I couldn't scream, but I was making every sound humanly possible with a mouth full of fine linen. It was dark there with my face in the dirt, my hair pulled tight straight out from my head as I was maneuvered down, down into the dark, damp earth. I could smell the earth, the garden, the familiar scent of decomposing leaves and sweet gum, tree roots. There was also a strong and growing stronger smell of formic acid, the smell of the species Formicidae. Ants, a metallic, lemony, citronella smell mixed with a sharp tang like lye soap. The smell of formic acid was the smell I knew, and as late as that afternoon, generally did not mind. Now I started thinking about dying with that smell in my nose so very strong it was making my eyes water. My whole head was now within the tunnel, and there were hundreds of wiry appendages brushing against my neck and face. I had hardly any breath left in me now, but suddenly, the wadded-up napkins were pulled from my mouth, probably by the friction of the tunnel walls as I was pushed and pulled further into the tunnel. With my mouth free, I began to scream and scream and scream, the shrieks reverberating in my ears in that small, dark place. There was a sudden flash of light, and then all was darkness again. Stillness for a second, and then something touching my hair, my face, not wiry legs, something soft and warm, something shaking me, and a new sound. The vibrating hissing had stopped, and I heard, "Fanny! Fanny, stop screaming!" I opened my eyes. My husband's face was as close to mine as frightfully large ants had been a few seconds before. My husband was patting my arms, untangling me from twisted sheets and blankets, and almost shouting, "Are you really so angry? For what? Because I left the peanut butter and jelly out on the counter all night?" When the ants go marching 10 by 10, ba-boom, ba-boom. When the ants go marching 10 by 10, ba-boom, ba-boom. When the ants go marching 10 by 10, we'll all be dead and skeletons then, and none of us left at the bitter end. When the ants go marching home.
Oh boy.
Did I frighten you, Stan?
I'm going to have a hard time going outside. Stay in the rest of the day. I love that story. It was creepy.
I'm going to tell that story this afternoon at Quaker Camp up on Catoctin Mountain.
Oh, good.
I hope they like it as much as you
I'm sure
do.
They will. You should have them all sit up with their feet on the benches. That was wonderful. So let's tell our listeners, you're listening to Enlightened Radio.
Oh, is that where we are?
Yes. Storytelling Hour. And if you want more stories,
podcast.
The podcast is talltales.enlightenradio.org. And there are many, many programs going back a year or more.
Oh my gosh, I was looking last night. They go all the way back to November 2016.
Wow, 2016. That's great. That's before I even existed in here. I wasn't even.
You were just a gleam in my eye, Stosh.
Right. Wow. Boy, that's a long time ago.
Okay, well, if we can shift gears, I'd like to tell. Our listeners about Stories in the Round.
I think it'd be a good idea.
Coming up on Monday, the 23rd, this month, July 23rd, at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown on Searfoss Pike, 13245 Searfoss Pike, just west of Hagerstown, just outside the city limits. And this month, we have coming to tell sacred stories, Magid Melvin Medlitz, traditional Magid, traditional in the sense that he's been trained and certified as a teller of Judaic sacred tales, but untraditional in the sense that I've known him all my life, and he didn't start out as a Magid. He started out as an elementary school teacher, and I've known him forever and ever and ever, and only recently learned that he's now a Magid. And so he will be coming and telling us stories, and I hope our listeners can come to hear Magid Melvin Medlitz, the whispering Magid. Melvin has only one vocal cord. He is 90 years old, just about to turn 90 years old, and I've heard him tell and mesmerize his audience with that single vocal cord. So you want to hear him. And if you want more information about tickets, or, well, I can tell you it's $10 in advance, $12 at the door. And you can call me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638. Or email me at Fanitsky, Fanitsky, at hotmail.com. And of course, there'll be more Stories in the Round coming up in September, October, November, December, through the season, but we'll tell you more about that next week.
Okay. And you can be sure that the at the church, at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, is an ant-free zone. So
I'll have to check that out in order to certify that particular. We have worms in the compost in the back, but that's outside.
That's for another time.
Yes. I hope. But right now, Stosh, you're going to tell a story. Maybe two.
I am.
Okay.
I'm going to tell a story. Our theme is life experiences. And this story is not scary. However, it's more serious. Well, that's Nothing could be more serious than what Finney just told, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not a great fan of creepy crawly things. So, but this has to do with, hair, actually, in a way. Very much so. In 1967, I applied for a coaching job at my high school alma mater. I was working at NASA at the time, doing research by myself. I spent 5 days a week, 8 hours each day, with a short break, charting numbers and doing leak rate studies on sealed components in spacecraft, which sounds very impressive, but it was extremely, extremely boring to a person such as myself, because I like people, and I was alone almost all day doing the work. So I read in the paper that my high school soccer coach had passed away, and I went to his funeral, and I immediately got the idea that I would apply for his coaching job. I didn't know what else I would do to make money. I was married for 1 year, and if I did get the coaching job, I would leave NASA, and I'm sure it would be a much lower pay, whatever I went to. Well, I went to the school and met with Brother John, the assistant principal, and he was in charge of sports, and he was very nice to me and assured me that he thought I would do a good job as a coach, but unfortunately, they had already hired a head coach. And he promised me he could get me into coaching immediately as an assistant if I would teach chemistry. I had a chemistry degree. No one had ever mentioned me as a teacher. Certainly not any of my teachers from high school would have thought that. But I really wanted to coach. I'd played soccer for many years and was still playing actively. And so I accepted the job. Actually, my wife at the time was very pleased because I was only going to be driving 27 miles to the school to teach from where we lived, instead of almost 50 miles to the place I was working for NASA. Of course, the salary was a bit lower, but I really didn't care. So my very first year as a chemistry teacher, I became an assistant coach to both the varsity and the JV soccer teams. And I was told that if I did a good job, there was a good chance that I could become the JV coach in the future, because Mr. Parks, who had been coaching at that school when I was a student years before, was going to retire. And he did retire. And I became the assistant varsity and junior varsity coach in 1969. Previous to that time, I did something that was momentous in my career. I grew a beard. I had worn a beard for a little while in college. I liked the way it looked. And so I started growing a beard. Well, I was an unpaid coach when I was not being paid to coach when I grew the beard, because I was just teaching and the soccer season was over. I was offered the varsity JV job, the junior varsity job for the 1969 season. But when I went to sign the contract, which was separate from my teaching contract, there was a little proviso on the bottom that said, Mr. Ziolkowski will shave in order to coach the team. I was stunned. I didn't sign the contract. I said I needed to think about something, and I was despondent. I couldn't believe that they didn't want me to coach because I wore a beard. It seemed crazy. But this was 1969. Lots of people were burning down buildings and were protesting the war and were giving beards a very bad name. And a good friend, the varsity coach, said to me, "Listen, shave your beard, coach the team. I know you'll do a great job, and they'll forget all about it. They'll see that you can do the job, and that the beard will go away." So I actually shaved my beard the last day of school that spring in my homeroom. And it was kind of fun. I was told later that the principal didn't appreciate the circus, but it was the last day of school and we never did anything real serious. Anyway, so I coached the 1969 junior varsity team, and the varsity coach's faith in me was justified. Our team had an 11-2 record, and we played the division champions from the other side of the city for the overall city championship. Unfortunately, the school we played against did not go by the general rule that juniors in high school should not play junior varsity soccer or any other sport. They had 6 starters on their team that were 11th graders. I had none. And we lost the game 2-1. But I got a lot of accolades at the school. People were really proud of the team. The junior varsity team had never done that well before. And the varsity coach said, "Now that beard won't be a problem." Well, the beard turned out to be a problem in another way. Christmas time, 1969, I went looking for a part-time job, teaching and coaching at a Catholic high school in the late 60s was not a great way to make money. And Christmas time was coming. I wanted to make a little extra money so that my young family could have a nice Christmas. And I looked in the paper and for different places, but one of the brothers, Brother Kevin, actually said, "You know, there's a large store right across the street. It's a big department store. They have all kinds of, I bet you can get a job there part-time. I've known people who worked there before." So I called the store and I spoke to a nice man and he said, "Oh, sure, come over after school and we can sign some papers and we'll get you fixed up for some hours." I was elated. I even called home, told my wife. After school, this was about probably 2 weeks before Christmas, I went over to the store, asked if I could see the manager, and waited outside his office for a little while. When I went in, one small detail, I have to back up. On November 11th, the last day of the season, when we played for the championship, I didn't shave. And so I had a beard again. So I met the manager, walked in, and he asked me why I wanted to see him. I told him I was interested in a job, that I had called and spoken to someone, and they said, yes, there were positions available part-time. And he looked at me and said, "I don't know why anyone would say that. We are not hiring anyone for Christmas work." So I left. And I couldn't get out of my mind that his voice sounded exactly like the one I had talked to on the phone. So later on, I found out that none of their employees had facial hair, not even mustaches, which would be expected for most of their employees because a majority of them were women. But so I did not get a job across the street for Christmas, but we managed to get through Christmas. And in the spring of 1970, came time to sign coaching contracts again. I was sure that the varsity coach's admonition about the beard would go away was no problem at all. And I went to the athletic director's office and picked up the contract, and it said, Mr. Ziolkowski will coach without a beard. Oh, I was devastated. I truly was devastated. And spent a good bit of time that afternoon before I went home realizing that wearing a beard was going to cause me problems, in that, at least at that school and in with that store. And so I made a decision about my life. I decided I would leave the school and I would apply for a job at a public school, because I was told that public school teachers wore beards. And I did get an interview at a public school, and the first person I met became one of my dearest friends for more than 45 years, Jay Butler, who was on hall duty. And I asked him for directions to the office. And when he looked up, I said, you have a beard. And he looked at me and said, so do you. And I was interviewed. I got the job. And I learned a life lesson that sometimes people will make judgments about you based on your appearance and not what you can do.
What a good lesson to learn at a relatively early age.
Yes, and my beard is now 50 years old.
Oh, my. It's almost as old as you are.
Oh. Not so much.
I do like that story.
Well, thank you.
Did you ever go back and talk to the guy at the store or the other high school? And
no. I was back to that high school one time, because a few years later, I was coaching soccer at the public school where I was also coaching track and teaching. And I lined up a practice game against their varsity with my varsity. And to my great pleasure, it was 2 years after I had left. And when we arrived in the school bus from the public school bus that took us to the game and pulled up alongside the fence surrounding the field at the private school, there was an enormous sign hung on the fence that said, welcome back, Mr. Z. And that was really very nice. And that had been put up by the varsity and junior varsity soccer teams.
That's wonderful.
So that was nice.
Very good.
So,
do you have another story that'll fit into the remaining time?
Yes, I have a short story.
Oh, good. Okay.
This is a life experience, another kind of learning, a real life learning experience. Which goes back a few years. In 1959, I graduated from high school. In those days, there weren't things like McDonald's. Now you can't go a mile in any, I don't even think a half mile in most cities, without seeing a McDonald's, a Burger King, Wendy's, all kind of things like that, where you can just walk in and get a job pretty much. So I filled out forms looking for jobs. I went for some interviews, but all the jobs were of the kind, like labor jobs. Even some government jobs were for workers in the shipyard at a steel mill. I weighed all of 110 pounds. And even though I got interviews, I was told by a very nice man at the Sparrows Point shipyard that I should probably look for some other kind of work, because most of the men that worked for him easily outweighed me by 100 to 150 pounds, and that the work was extremely strenuous, And he wasn't sure it would be good for me to try that kind of work because I wasn't very big and I wasn't very strong. So I went to downtown Baltimore to the court building and walked through the halls and talked to three different men. One was for the Navy recruiter. Another was the Air Force recruiter. And the third was an Army recruiter. Well, the Navy wanted me to sign him for 4 years. The Air Force wanted me to sign him for 4 years. But the Army only wanted me to sign him for 3 years. And they didn't say anything about my size. In fact, the sergeant I talked to greeted me like a long-lost brother. And I told him I wanted to do my patriotic duty and serve in the Army of my country. He was so delighted with that, he knocked on the door of in an office, and the captain came out, and he said, "Captain, you need to hear this." And I repeated that I wanted to do my patriotic duty. The grins on their faces didn't make sense to me until I was already in the Army and realized what I was talking to seasoned veterans, and they got a kick out of that. And so that experience was that I chose to go in the Army. And it turned out to be a great decision. I wasn't sure of that for a few months, especially in basic training. But the 3 years I spent in the Army taught me that I could do anything that I was capable of as long as I was willing to sacrifice and pay the price.
You have some great Army stories for another day.
Yes.
More personal experiences, life experiences.
Yes, I do. 3 years worth.
Yeah.
I think of my 3 years in the Army as very close to the comic strip Beetle Bailey.
You weren't Beetle.
No. Not all the time, but I had some Beetle Bailey experiences.
That is a great comic strip. One of my dad's favorites. Also, Army vet. Are you going to close this out today?
I think I will, if I can remember all the words I'm supposed to say. I can tell you, you've been listening to the EnlightenRadio.org Storytelling Hour, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, and with co-host Stosh Steelkowski and
Fanny Crawford.
And here we go. I am closing today's community radio from Bolivar, West Virginia. Tune in next Monday at 12 noon for more storytelling. The Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all our stories. Join us next week, same time, same URL, for more storytelling. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for
Rock and Roll.
Rock and Roll.
Okay, and we will be back next week. And I think our theme next week is actually
choices.
Choices. So you'll be hearing stories about choices. But thanks for joining us this week. And please come out for Stories in the Round on Monday the 23rd. And for Speak story series as well in Shepherdstown, if you can do that. Podcasts for this program at talltales.enlightenradio.org. Till next time.